You're listening to the music of Aaron Heating, known to the arts world as Heatbox. We'll listen to an interview recorded with him later this hour. Right now, though, we're joined in studio by UW-Madison's artist-in-residence, Faisal Abdullah. His work turns our perceptions upside down and shakes loose our assumptions about things like race, identity, masculinity, and faith. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Faisal Abdullah is our guest this hour, the first half of the hour. He's won numerous prizes, including the Anonymous Arts Award, the Brittingham Fellow Award, and the IDA Award. And again, he is the UW-Madison's Artist in Residence with several events coming up as well. And Faisal Abdullah, good to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Veronica.
Well, you have had this incredible arc of a career that involves so much self-discovery, so much exploration. Can you tell us when you first realized that you were an artist?
I think for me, you know, born and raised in London, my parents were from Jamaica. What I kind of realized in my home growing up as a child, I did a lot of illustrations, did a lot of drawings. And drawings was a way of me creating space around me. So my brothers and sisters wouldn't come near me. And the more and more I began to get kind of lost in the dream space of drawing, the more I began to feel it felt comfortable. And, you know, as a young kid, going to the barbershop, you know, in homes of the Caribbean community that's set up in London, I became very curious when I was looking at the barber, cutting the shapes and the lines in the people's hair, and I thought, that feels like drawing. So I always kind of felt this kind of connection with line, with shape, with form, and began to feel that it just felt kind of comfortable. And when I was at school, my art teacher, Mr. May, he took me to the National Portrait Gallery. And back then it was unusual. You know, he'd walk around in a flight jacket, he'd have this big moustache and this like really funky scarf. And he took these three kids to the National Portrait Gallery. And I never forget when I walked in and I just felt like I was at home because I was looking at these paintings all the way through my school years, making copies of them and seeing them in the flesh and just being in the spirit of the space, it just kind of felt right.
How old were you when you took that visit?
I must have been about 13 years old. And, you know, you're telling your father you're going to the gallery to look at some art. He's like, what? Going to the gallery? What for? You know? For them, it was for people who were no longer around. It was primarily for white people. It wasn't something that my father really kind of connected with. So it was, I was pushing against the grain of you know, my culture in a way.
Well, it's interesting because your culture has gone on to inform your artwork so much. And I know you tell stories about growing up as a black family in London and having, you know, the atmosphere there. You know, we know what it was like in America, but in London, your family, at the end of a night, a gathering with many families, would have to work out this elaborate sort of walk just to get people home safely.
Yeah. I mean, my father, you know, in the 60s when they came to London, you know, race was a big issue, you know, and, you know, they would only have kind of menial work in factories and stuff. And what they realized was that they formed relationships very quickly with, you know, colleagues that were living in the same district as them in Jamaica. So what they found out, there was a kind of friction between the Teddy Boys and the skinheads in London.
Wait, what are the Teddy Boys?
The Teddy Boys, essentially, they're kind of fashionista. They used to have gelled hair and they used to wear long coats and they used to like kind of rock and roll. But they essentially didn't like people of color. So they were the kind of, they were the forerunners before the skinheads. And what my father and his friends realized was that when they'd be walking home from work, they would get attacked at certain points on the road in West London, which is near where the carnival happens in Ladbroke Grove. So what they did was they employed a strategy. When they were walking home, there would be like 8 or 9 of them. And each time they would get to somebody's house, they'd drop somebody off. Then there were 7. Then there were 6. Then there were 5. And then the last 2 people who were walking back, you would never drop that person off. You'd stay at that person's house. So in effect, you would never walk on your own at night. You'd always walk in 2s and 3s. So they employed this strategy, and that was the way in which that they managed to kind of make a kind of difference and make a presence. And also, you know, in some ways, build a foundation for me as a young man growing up in the 70s.
Now, it's interesting because it's such a beautiful system that speaks to the community that surrounds you. On the other hand, it's sickening that you had to walk home like that, that you couldn't just walk home.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and I think that did, in a way, it framed my kind of my consciousness. What it did, it made me think about my own self within the landscape. It made me think about the two worlds that I was occupying. So, you know, my parents would be in the house and they would teach me all the values from Jamaica, the foods and, you know, how to kind of be ethical and be sensible. And then when I would leave that threshold of the front door, they'd say, when you go outside, you need to do this, do that. Mm. Make sure you go into a shop, there's money in your pocket. You know, there were all these kind of subtle rules that they would tell me that I had to do. So I had to put on this almost like invisible coat of armor when I went outside. So I was living in these kind of two worlds, but in the same world. And, you know, that kind of complexity began to then play out in me as a person. And then it had to manifest through making art. So art was the way that I could kind of make sense of it. You know, it was almost like a way of, it was almost like meditation in a way. A way that I could somehow make sense of this complexity of me as an individual, as a black individual, but also why is society making these assumptions about me at this very, very young age? And why were my parents kind of almost, not victims, but they were exposed to this type of kind of response to their presence being in London? So it was quite complicated growing up as a child in London.
Yeah, and making sense of it is something you can't really do because it doesn't make any sense. It seems like the best you can hope to do is process it.
Yeah.
And that is what your art does. And
Absolutely.
If we flash forward to one of your, I guess it's maybe your most controversial exhibit, where you have images of black men, and in some of the images, they're holding guns. And that created a huge uproar, didn't it? Do you want to describe it more and tell us what happened?
Yeah. I mean, I Wanna Kill Sam was my first major body of work that I did in 1993. And it was depicting colleagues of mine who I knew, I still know, and they were rappers, you know. And when you understand London, London takes a lot of its kind of direction from the US. So a lot of the guys at the time were listening to rap music as a vehicle of articulating their thoughts and their reactions to the system, and a way of politicizing their bodies. And I just felt, you know, what I could then do was to take it to another level by, you know, creating these images that would sit within the gallery space. So I'd strip them away from all their kind of urban connotations, clean them up, and kind of re-represent them back to the public. So these guys were in urban clothes, holding hand weapons, some giving them back to the viewer, some pointing them at the viewer, and some holding them as if they were kind of posing in a very kind of provocative way. And they were printed onto steel, so they almost became murals. And when you look at the body of the actual print, because it's printed onto metal, the bodies are slightly fragmented. So the closer you become to the work, the more the body becomes fragmented. The further back you stand from the work, the more it kind of comes together. And the kind of responses that I had from the Photographers' Gallery in London were people said I'd pushed race relations back 30 years. You know, people were coming into the gallery and saying they were going to destroy the work. Mm. They were saying, you know, why am I, as a black person, creating these very, very negative images of men holding handguns? And I says, well, you know, there came a turning point when I gave a lecture, and I just gave them a simple analogy. I said, you know, I grew up on a staple diet of James Bond and Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger, Bruce Willis. You know, I can name numerous amounts of white men that have held handguns for entertainment. But yet you pay your money, you go to the theater, you see them on the posters, and you see it as the norm. Whenever the black body holds the gun, for some reason, the black body is always the aggressor. It is always the deviant form, whereas the white male is the liberator with the handgun. And in some ways, the response that I got from the individuals, I said, well, the works act like mirrors. Whatever you say about that subject is in effect how society has conditioned your mind to think about the black body.
That's so interesting, thinking about them as mirrors. I mean, did it work that way? Did you shake some people out of that complacency, or at least their own assumptions? Or was it just something that was too difficult for people to swallow at that point?
In the beginning, it was very difficult, because I always believe, you know, that art, you know, good art comes from a place of honesty. And in the very first 2 years, it was very difficult for the work to find its feet. And then what was really beautiful, there were a few scholars, people like Stuart Hall, Mark Seeley, David A. Bailey, and they were writing Kubona Mercer. They were writing about the work and how it, you know, and they were looking at me as a second generation of Black British artists that were making this kind of commentary. And they were kind of somehow supporting the approach that I was kind of putting forward as a theory. And once the kind of the affirmation came through books, then the public came back on board. They became my friend. They became my ally.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, that, and it sounds in a sense like you needed that academic backup to make it, I don't know, either accessible or safe.
I mean, I think it's very important. You know, I did a project called Spine some years ago, and Spine came about when I went into the library to research some artists, and I was looking for artists of colour. And what I found was the artists of colour had the thinnest spines, and the artists who were not of colour had the big spines. So the Andy Warhols, big spines. You know, de Kooning, big spines. The Sonia Boyces, tiny spines, almost like brochures. So what's really important in the art world is, you know, they are the artists, the practitioners, and they're the writers, the historians. And it's so important that there is a relationship between the two, because historians need the artists to make the work for them to write about. And the artists need to make the work that historians can then write about. So we exist in the kind of, you know, right, in the canon of art history.
I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking this first half hour with our guest, Faisal Abdu'Allah. He is an artist in residence at the UW-Madison this year, and we're talking about his work, and he does have some exciting things coming up that we're going to tell you about in a bit. But first, we have to get into some of what you're doing now. We've talked about your artwork a little bit. Part of your artwork and part of what you do and what's kind of completed you as an artist is this work you do in the barbershop. Now, let's put it plainly, you cut hair. You cut people's hair. But you're not just any barber. I mean, when we talked on the phone yesterday, you talked about putting the New York skyline on the back of some guy's head. So this is extraordinary work we're seeing, but it's also more than that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think when I did a student exchange in 1989, and I came to the US for the first time, 19-year-old kid, you know, didn't know anything about the world. And I was here for 5 weeks, and I needed a haircut. So I went to downtown Boston, walked through the streets, stopped all the black guys to ask them, you know, where can I find a barber's? Found a barber's, wasn't happy. Went back to the campus, and they kept calling me English. Hey, English, come over here. How you doing? You know, did you have your haircut English? And I says, yeah, I did, but I didn't. I wasn't happy with it. And there was this guy there called Chris Bell, wonderful soul. And he said, oh, you know, I could cut your hair for you. And I went to his room, and I saw this guy with two mirrors and the clippers. And
so this just a guy on campus?
On campus, yeah. He was one of the students.
A student?
And a few weeks later, he had a shoulder injury, and he couldn't cut his hair. And he asked me to do it for him. And when I did it, it was as if I'd done it before. And, you know, fast forward, came back to London, carried on cutting hair, and a local barber saw my nephew walking past him one day, and I'd put a skyline in the back of his head. And he called him into the shop and said, hey, who did that skyline in the back of your head? I was my uncle, you know, but he's at art school today. He's not home yet. When he comes home, you tell him to come and see me. And this barber offered me a spot in the shop on a Saturday whilst I was studying on my master's degree at Royal College. And then I started to work there because, you know, it meant I had more time to dedicate to my work because I was only working there on a Saturday. And it meant also that, you know, I could, you know, begin to use some of the stories and the narratives that were coming out of the barbershop and invest those ideas into the work.
So you called it before something like an unofficial university, and you're talking about the stories that come out of it. What are some of those stories? What are some of those moments? And I guess kind of what makes a barbershop, besides the hair going on the floor?
What makes a barbershop is the people, it's the narratives. And, you know, we were fortunate to cut a lot of celebrities, actors, and people that, you know, just from the local community.
Is that in your shop in London you're talking about
the shop
now?
Shop in London, yeah.
It's called Faisal's.
It's called Faisal's, and it doubles up as a barbershop and my studio underneath.
How long does it take to get an appointment at Faisal's?
You can walk in and get one straight away, yeah.
Would you cut hair, though, or do you have other people?
Other guys are doing the cutting.
Okay.
But I'm there kind of, you know, on a Saturday. Some Saturdays I'm there. You know, one of the kind of interesting stories that we kind of had was there was a guy who he would come in every week. I'd cut his hair, and he would talk about his relationship with his girlfriend. And he was, you know, he was playing three or four women at the same time. And he was saying he was going out for the night. And he came back the following week because he always comes in with his, you know, to get his haircut. And he had on some sunglasses. So I was like, hey, how you doing? He's like, oh, I'm fine. And I goes, well, you need to take your glasses off because I need to, you know, do the mark around the front of your head. And he had this really bad bruise on his eye. So I goes, what happened? He says, oh, I went to the cinema. And I goes, what happened? I went to get some popcorn. Yeah. And he saw his girlfriend's friend in the foyer. So she goes, well, what are you doing here? He goes, I'm just getting some popcorn. And he goes, so is your girlfriend here? I think her name was, I don't know, Michelle or something. He goes, not quite. But he was there with somebody else. And it transpired that she was on the phone to his girlfriend, and she bruised him up.
Yeah. He got a shiner.
Yeah, he got a shiner. So, you know, for me, it's a very interesting space where it's a crossroad of kind of ideas, of emotions, and thought processes.
And it sounds fascinating, like a merging for you of sort of this inner calling in art and just sort of this kinetic thing of being working in someone's hair. It's fascinating. And the cool thing is that you can have the opportunity to see Faisal cutting hair live. There will be a live salon event at the Wisconsin Institute of Discovery on Wednesday, April 3rd. And then you're also a featured barber in the film coming out called The Fade. And that features you and I think three other barbers from around the world, right? And you're the London guy. Yeah. And that's screening at 7 o'clock at Union South. I think that's also on April 3rd. So we've got a lot of stuff going on there. We'll post some of this on our Facebook page if you want to keep up. And if you'd like to see Faisal cutting hair as part of an art exhibition, because it's, you know, it's more than just cutting people's hair.
Yeah. I mean, it's about a conversation. It's about the audience becoming a part of the work. It's almost like a collaboration between myself, the subject who's getting their hair cut, and the audience. And they can ask me anything they want about life, love, relationships, other than finance.
Money's off the table, huh?
Money's off the table.
What is that? Well, I think we're getting close to the end of the hour here, but what is the most what are the most moving things someone's ever told you while you're cutting their hair?
I think the most moving thing that I did was I was cutting this lady from Zimbabwe, white lady, and her hair was, she had very long hair, blonde, and she wanted it very short, and a pineapple tree in the side of her head. So I began to cut her hair down, and as I cut the hair down, the machine began to stop. And when I lifted up her hair, underneath her hair was like mine. She had hair like mine. And it transpired that her great-grandfather was black. And she had been relaxing her hair all of those years. And the Life Salon gave her the confidence and the belief to remove that and be proud of, you know, of her hair. Because in some respects, our hair is part of our DNA.
Yeah.
And it's the traces of who we are and where we've been or where our forefathers have been.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's a great place to leave it. Faisal, I wish we had more time, but thank you so much for coming in this hour.
Thank you for having me.
We're speaking this hour with Faisal Abdullah. He's a British artist and has won numerous prizes and awards, including the Anonymous Arts Award and the Brittingham Fellow Award. Lots of events for Faisal coming up at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and we'll post those on our Facebook page for you to check out. And coming up, we'll be talking with Aaron Heaton, better known in the arts world as Heatbox. This from an interview we recorded a while back. We'll be taking a listen to that next. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. He's a drum, a beat, a trumpet, and a harmonica. He can even be a guitar. Aaron Heaton is the one-man sound system called Heatbox. With only his voice and a pedal-triggered loop system, Heatbox creates a full orchestra sound that tap dances on the cusp between jazz, hip-hop, soul, and funk. To get the full picture of what Heatbox is doing using only his voice, stop by our website or our Facebook page. Heatbox recently stopped by our Madison studios and treated us to a personal concert. I watch these today. Let me say, you blow me away. I mean, watching you perform is amazing. And you kind of feel like you're watching somebody breaking the laws of physics in front of your eyes. And as far as I can tell, you don't actually have magical powers. But how do you pull this off?
I don't know. I've been doing it for a long time now. So I have a weird skill that I've been doing over and over.
Well, you know, everyone says, the scientists say that men cannot multitask, right? That women are supposed to be the ones who can do a whole bunch of things at once. And I always prided myself on being able to check email and text and, you know, place a phone call, listen to voicemail all at once. But after watching you, I have an inferiority complex. You're doing about 10 different things at once. With your feet, you've got two pedals that you use. I mean, you're building this music from the ground up.
Yes.
So I guess what I'd ask you is, if you were going to describe this to someone who had no idea what you do, how would you describe it?
It's like a one-man funky a cappella group from space. From deep in outer space. Looking through the bar, keeping trying to keep it straight, it's straight in front of to the microphone to put it in its place. Deep inside my brain, it sends a signal through my mouth, and then I move my lips and tongue and use my lungs to push it out. For a fraction of a second, it's a dirty wave of sound until it slams into the microphone and starts to travel down. I don't even know if you're liking it or not. I don't think it's cool, no, I think it's really hot. All the people shaking it, you show them how to rock, and all the people shaking it, you show them how to rock. Here we go. Yeah. Here we go. On the wire like a fire in the forest just before the forest fire. Sneaking through the snake, banging through the gun for hire. Then he cranks it up and sends it to the super amplifier. If you see me live, then the signal hits your speakers. Hopefully it's loud enough to make you move your sneakers. Creeping through the mind like the creepiest of creepers. Now you hear the sound that I was shouting like I was a preacher. I don't even know if you're liking it or not. I don't think it's cool, no, but I think it's really hot. All the people shaking it, you show them how to rock. And all the people shaking it, you show them how to rock. Here we go.
So it's a visual thing, and I'm going to urge everybody to go to our Facebook page, go to our website, and watch this, because I don't think you'll understand unless you see it that these songs, which are richly layered, it's all just you. It's coming from your mouth and these beats that you lay down and some scratching, virtual scratching with your mouth that you do.
Yeah.
And you loop it, right?
Yep. Start first by looping a bunch of beats and bass lines and some harmonies. And then on the pedal that I have, you can make things go away and come back. So you can drop out the drums and bring them back later. And, you know, the whole time you're doing trombone solos with your mouth over it and stuff. So whatever you want to do.
And they really sound like a trombone solo. I mean, so do you just soak this stuff up and it comes out your mouth, or do you have to work on it?
Yeah, just, I think I have extreme OCD of the mouth, probably. Like, I don't even really realize it anymore, but, like, my friends tell me, like, if I hand them something and they grab it from my hand, I'll make a little, like, bing or, like, burr, or noise or whatever. Like, my life is like a cartoon that I exist in, that I make all these sounds all the time.
you could break it down for us and tell us if there's kind of an ABC of the sounds that you make. It sounds like you make a lot of them up as you go along, but when you're putting together tracks, what's in your toolbox? You know, this is my scratch and this is my, you know, doo-wop. What are some of those basic sounds? I just wonder if you could make some sounds for us.
Yeah, definitely. Well, almost all the songs start with drums, so, and that's because if you mess up the rhythm of the loop, it's going to sound bad every time it starts over again. It won't line up correctly. So I always do drums first to make sure that everything's rock solid, and then everything else can fit on top. So the drums are like... Once you get that going, you can add a... And then a... And then you got all that going, and then you... Then once all that's going, you can... Trombones over, whatever you want to do over it.
Oh, you can you? You can.
No, you just do that.
Well, how did you grow up? I mean, I guess I wonder if you were a freakish little kid who just heard the world differently than everybody else heard it.
Yeah, I don't know. I was always playing video games, so that's a thing that a little sound happens whenever you do almost anything in a video game. And we were all beatboxing in high school, and because Rozelle made that Make the Music 2000 album in 2000 where he sings and beatboxes at the same time, and that blew all of our high school minds, and so we were all a bunch of white kids in the garage trying to beatbox and freestyle and stuff like that. And I guess I was the only one that kept going.
Well, your first track is called Here We Go. I don't know if you say it. How did you say it?
Here We Go.
All right, that's better. Tell us about that track.
That's a new one, and it's not done, which is why I did the verse twice, because I don't have a second verse yet. But it's my new favorite song, and it's all about actually the process of not trying to force a song to get made, but to just sort of dial it in by finding it in the universe. It's already out there. You just have to make it correct. As it flows from the universe into your brain, and then in your brain, I'm making the beat into my beat in my mouth, and then I'm singing it and I'm yelling it at the microphone, and it's all about the process of how it goes down the microphone cord and comes out the speakers at your ear holes.
Now, that's kind of cosmic, isn't it? Are you talking
totally
about a spiritual element to this music?
I don't purposely do spiritual elements in the music, but a lot of people come up to me and tell me that that's what they hear.
You said it's out there already, though, that it exists and that you're just kind of channeling it.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean,
isn't
that kind of mystical?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess it could be considered kind of mystical. I mean, I do believe it's already out there. I do believe the painting you're going to paint is already out there, and the book you're going to write is already out there. You just have to do a good job of being an antenna.
Well, if these songs are out there, they must love you, because I bet there aren't too many channels for them. They must cluster around you, dying to get into your head.
Maybe that's why I have good luck. And now I'm picking up a dog, keeping deep and out of space. A dollar line it up, it turns into a beat behind my face. Looking through the bar, keeping trying to keep it straight. It's straight in front of through the microphone to put it in its place. Deep inside my brain, it's in the signal to my mouth. And then I move my lips and tongue and use my lungs to push it out. For a fraction of a second, it's a dirty wave. It's not until it slams into the microphone and starts to travel down. I don't even know if you're liking it or not. I don't think it's cool, no, I think it's really hot. All the people shaking it, you show them how to rock it. All the people shaking it, you show them how to rock it. Here we go.
Well, were you a DJ when you started out? Because I noticed one of the things you do, and you'll see this in these videos of you performing, is that you're kind of scratching on an air turntable in perfect sync and perfect rhythm. Did you start out as a DJ?
You know, I was a wedding DJ for a little while, but we didn't do a lot of record scratching during that time. I did a lot of CD playing and a lot of playing of Celebration, and I had a wonderful, I had the time of my life. I did a lot of that song.
Do you have a version of that one?
No, God, I should.
That would be hilarious.
That would be so funny. But yeah, the air scratching and stuff, it's like something I have to do. Otherwise, I can't feel what I'm doing if I don't pretend I'm actually doing something.
Now, it's kind of hard to describe your music. That's why I want people to see it. And it's also hard to describe it because you fuse so many different styles together. You do jazz, R&B, rap, hip-hop, doo-wop. I mean, it's all in there. Is there a way that you conceptualize it? Or is it, again, this is just sort of how it comes out of you?
Definitely, that's just how it comes out of me. I don't try to overthink it very much. I'm not purposely really doing any specific kind of sound. But I do like to mix it up a lot because it's lucky because most bands have to kind of pick a style. But since mine is a weird sound instead of a style, I can kind of do whatever style I want as long as the beatboxing, you know, sort of makes everything come together.
Autobots, let's ride.
Well, I want to go back to how you create this music and what it's like to be inside it, because as I watched you performing this stuff, it sort of gave me the feeling of being sort of inside a wave, like a surfer riding a really amazing wave. Maybe you're inside the tube and you have to hold on or you're going to fall off. Does it ever feel like that to you?
Yeah, well, it feels like the whole wave is my fault. If it's a good wave or a bad wave, that's for sure. Like, there's nobody to give the blame to if it's bad, you know? It's just me up there. So I do feel like, yeah, like I have to try to control it as best I can. A friend of mine called it a cockpit. He's like, I want to try the cockpit. I want to try flying the spaceship.
How did it go?
He had a good time.
Yeah.
Yeah. We weren't in public or anything. We were just in his living room, but he had a pretty good time.
Have you ever been on stage performing this and you feel like you could just fall off the edge, that you're barely holding on to it?
Yeah, actually, I had a really bad anxiety attack a couple years ago, right at the beginning of my set, like the first song. And I'd never experienced anything like that before, and I had a terrible anxiety attack, and I thought I was going to pass out, and I wanted to run away from the stage, and it was really awful. I kept dumping water, cold water on my head, even though it was really cold out. I was really scared. I was actually scared to death, but I did the whole set and got through it.
Did it ever happen again?
Actually, it stuck around, and slowly went away over the course of a year and a half, so I would go to shows and I would tell the audience, hey, everybody, I'm not feeling so good, so I'm going to have this bucket of ice water next to me and try to make myself feel okay. And I didn't tell them I was anxious. I just told them I was sick. And so I don't know. I kept doing shows, though, and kept doing it and kept doing it. And eventually the feeling went away, thank God.
So you just powered through it, because a lot of people, when they have panic attacks, I mean, that's serious. I've had anxiety. I mean, a lot of people go and get medication because it's terrifying.
Yes.
And when it's happening in front of people, it's, you know, amplified times whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. It was one of the worst things that I've ever experienced, ever.
Yeah, because I wondered about it myself. I've never gotten treatment either. I just sort of, you know, assume that it will go away, but then you always kind of wonder, well, is it going to come back? Because I don't really understand it. I don't know why it happened. Sounds like you don't know why it happened. It just happened.
Yeah. I'd already done, you know, 1,000 shows before that show, and there's something about that exact moment in time. And then the fear of it is the worst part. You get anxiety wondering if you're going to get anxiety again, you know?
Right. It's a loop.
Yeah, it's stupid. Yeah, it's a loop. Definitely it's a loop. So maybe that's why I could figure it out and eventually get around it.
Well, on the other hand, it gives you anxiety, but a lot of people describe your music as inspirational. So it must also be on the flip side. When everything is working, it must be a kind of a high.
Definitely. And then everything that happens good is my fault, too. So I get all the glory if things go well, and I get all the other end of glory if things go terribly. But yeah, if things are going well, then it feels awesome. When I'm done with a show that I really liked, that is the best.
Because I just want to give you something I know that's not real. And then you come talk to me, say that you can feel. Now what we do tonight, drink some booze and feel all right. But I do.
The one-man music machine, Aaron Heaton, better known as Heatbox. As we head into this break, take a moment to check out a video of Heatbox's performance in our Madison studios. It's posted on our Facebook page at Veronica Rickert Show. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Veronica Rickert here with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm talking to composer, producer, and one-man band, Heatbox. He joined us at our Madison studios recently to show us how he creates the sound of a full band using only his voice. And you do all these instruments in your tracks. You do a harmonica, you do a trombone, I heard a trumpet. I bet there's others that I don't even know about. Can you give us a few of those just on their own, or do you need your pedal to do that?
No, I can do all sorts of stuff. You do the harmonica. It's like... the trumpet would be like... or the...
I like that one. Which one is your favorite?
I like that one, too. That one usually gets a crowd to giggle a little bit, so I like that one.
Well, what's cool about it is you're a talented guy. You could learn to play all of these instruments, to play them. Maybe you do play them, but you'd rather make the noises with your mouth. Why?
Oh, that's more fun. Definitely more fun. And I think it's more fun for an audience to watch a weirdo make all the sounds of his mouth. And I don't have to carry around a bass and a trumpet and a drum set.
Right.
So that's nice.
Well, do you think that, I'm sure you've heard that before, that all of the musical instruments were created in imitation of the human voice. So maybe there's nothing more perfect.
Right. Maybe I just looped back to the beginnings of sound back when we didn't have instruments. It's like the oldest thing ever, using the newest technology to loop it.
So you've got a pedal, speaking of looping, to do your looping. And the other thing that you use, these are the only things on stage with you pretty much as far as I can tell, is like a vocal effects pedal. What does that one do?
That has like an octave shifter, so I can make my voice go down an octave, which is super low, and push it up an octave, super high. It also has a little bit of a reverb if I want to turn that on. And it has a wah function. So I'm going... doing some guitar kind of chukka 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 thing, and that just makes it even more, puts like a flange kind of effect on it.
Cool.
You can program anything you want into there, and I've got like 12 things that I've programmed in there and saved.
Wow, I don't know if you have kids. but I bet kids think you're the bomb.
No, I don't have any kids. No, but
if you ever, when you do, yeah. Or you know, the ones that come over to your house, what could be more cool than fooling around with a voice like this? You know how kids are fascinating. I did this; like, I had a tape recorder and I would make noises yes. into it for hours and hours.
Yes,
I'm guessing you do yeah. that too.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun. I do a lot of school shows and go to elementary schools or sometimes high schools or colleges, and almost everyone has a good time making sounds in their mouth. Especially when you try to get the teacher to do something, then all the kids freak out.
Is there a favorite thing that you like to do when you're messing around or when you're first creating a song, maybe?
Yeah. I have my little office studio at my house, and I just sit around and sometimes spend a day just trying to make a new song and record it and then see if I hate it or not. And if it's a good song, then a lot of times I'll get obsessed by it and listen to it over and over and try to think of how to make it better. But that's a really good time is being like, yeah, I really like this, and I just made it, and it's really hot off the presses, and no one else has heard it except for me.
Hmm.
That's what I like to do at my house anyway.
You're creator of your universe, master of the universe.
I hope so. I like to think so.
Well, the last song that you sang for us is called Man Versus Machine. You want to tell us about that one?
That sprung up when I first got my hands on that crazy pedal that we were talking about. Because that thing can make crazy turntable scratching sound that a human could never make. So I was doing that. I wanted to show people that this is what I sound like when I'm just beatboxing, and this is what I sound like when I use the pedal. And I guess I'll make them battle each other, because that's always exciting, pulling battles.
And then with all that room and no maps and no guide, started feeling lost with no place to hide. Living on the road and questioning the ride. Said there's not a dance, just a piece of peace inside. Said there's not a dance, said it's not a dancing, justifying. Said it's not a dancing. It's yeah, do, 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 do. Now here's a man, here we go with the man versus the machine. Sheen, man, a man versus machine. This is the man, a man. This is the man, a man. This is the man, a man. This is the man.
Is there a more to the man versus machine part of it?
You mean like mystically?
Well, you could go mystically, but I guess I just meant you were trying to draw out the fact that you are using technology, but you're also this guy who's just singing.
Right. Yeah, I kind of wanted to give, it's almost like a sneak peek hint at how stuff works, actually. Because when I perform it, I usually point down at the pedal when I'm doing that part, and I don't point at the pedal when I'm doing I point at my own self when I'm not using it. So you can see when I turn it on, when I turn it off, to battle my own self.
They hit the road with no destination. Is it every time with no hesitation? Ventures and comments, they were poets and clowns. They dance in small stages, they sing in small towns. They dance in big arms, big steps and loud shoes. Play with all the rhythm and dance away the blues. Play with all the rhythm and dance away the blues. Play with all the rhythm, dance away the blues. Play with all the rhythm, dance away the blues. Play with all the rhythm, dance away the blues. They play with all the rhythm, dance away the blues. They play with all the rhythm, dance away the blues. Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, let's have a toast. Reverse it.
What does your mom think about what you do? Does she get it?
At first, they were not sold. on what it was or if I would ever be able to, you know, they were like, well, we really love you and really want you to, you know, enjoy what you do in your life. So I guess that's okay. But now that they've seen me do it for years and I've actually gotten to make a living off of it and travel around the world sometimes with it, I think they are like pretty proud.
That's amazing. You know how in our culture it sort of seems, and this was the idea of the folk movement, I guess, that anybody could make music. I feel like sometimes we've gotten away from that, that people don't feel like they can sing. You don't ever, almost, unless you're seeing a busking musician walk down the street and hear people singing as they go through their life, go through their, you know, their work day. Even singing kids to bed doesn't seem like it happens that much. I mean, do you think people are more afraid to use their voices?
Wow, that's a crazy question. I don't think so. I think people are singing just as much as they ever did.
You do?
Yeah, I like to think so. I mean, kids are singing. Kids will always be singing. So you always got your kids. See, those kids are covered. They're singing just as much as the kids have always sung.
What about grown-ups?
And grown-ups, I don't know. I bet from the beginning of time, grown-ups have sung less and less as they got older and older. I don't know.
You think that's going to happen to you?
No, I don't know. I hope not. I hope when I'm an old man, I can find other old men and make an old man band to hang out.
That's a great name right there. The old man band. Ended there, but my producer Marika Suval forced me to try to beatbox with Aaron. Here's what happened. I don't beatbox. I once had a lesson in scratching, and oh my god, was that humbling.
Oh man.
Okay. Do you have?
I mean, everybody can go. Everybody can go. Right. Yeah. Now, can you just go?
Maybe not. Or you have a simpler one?
We'll do the like you do that.
Are you snapping?
No.
I can snap.
That counts. You can Bobby McFerrin body slap.
All right, I'll body slap then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hope we didn't just ruin the interview that I did by doing that together.
No, that was fun. That was super cool. I think my 7-year-old is going to like it. All right, well, Mr. Heatbox, thank you very much. I loved it.
Thanks for having me. It was awesome.
All right, thank you. That was Aaron Heaton, better known as the one-man entertainment system Heatbox. He has 2 albums under his belt, and he's working on a 3rd. We hope you enjoyed that musical adventure as much as we did. And speaking of adventures, I've got some news I want to share with you. March 29th will be my last day with you on this Friday show. I'm going to miss being here with you so much, but I'm also really excited to be moving on to new vistas here at Wisconsin Public Radio. I'll be back on the air in a couple of months, and I'll be meeting up with you again. and we'll see what we can build together as I take on a new hosting job with my friend and colleague Rob Ferret. And here on Fridays, Ann Strange Champs will be taking over the reins, and we'll have lots of great stuff in store for you coming up then. And in the meantime, I'll see you next Friday here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to Brittany True, Joe Hartke, and Tom Blaine for technical direction, and to Marika Suval, who produced and edited this hour. I'm Veronica Rickert with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, you guys, for watching me today.